Effin' Birds is a daily comic strip that pairs angst about the shit show we live in with beautiful drawings of birds. Find it on your social media platform of choice, in good bookstores, and at effinbirds.com.
I've started a GoFundMe to help Elon Musk buy every social media site in the world. This is the Soft Revolution. My name is Torkel Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
Thank you for joining us again. We're joined by Ali.
Yeah, he's doing good for the cause, man. He's doing good for the cause.
He sure is. He's my MVP for this year. We're joined today by Ali Moman's dog, Rumi, who is sitting directly behind him, looking
hey,
like
Rumi,
he's listening to every word, being hanging on every word. But we're also joined by a fascinating artist. His name is Michael Wheeler, and he runs something called the Spiderweb Project. Is that right, Ali?
Spiderweb Show.
Spiderweb
He's a director of artistic research at the Spiderweb Show.
And the Spiderweb Show is, tell us about it.
Well, the Spiderweb Show is, just going by what they have here, is the first and only nationally driven performing arts website of its kind in Canada. It is a practice-based network where cultural change is captured and examined. I mean, their ultimate kind of purpose is to collectively, with as many thinkers as possible, to answer the question, what defines Canadian theater, or what in general is theater? And the big kind of premise is for them is to be like, okay, where does theater, Canada, the internet, technology, and live performance connect? So it's really that kind of place where it's the intersection of technology and the arts.
Big question. Big question.
Yeah, big question. And Michael, you know, for a very long time, and he talks about it in the interview, you know, this is a classically trained actor, Moscow Art Theater, but for a long time, he's been interested in how technology can integrate into live performance. He is a big proponent and also user and creator in respect to virtual reality, mixed reality, augmented reality. So we talk a lot about that.
And in fact, he just directed a show entirely in the metaverse, people. How cool is that?
In VR, yeah.
Yeah, entirely called You Should Have Stayed Home. It's about one man's journey through the G20 protests in Toronto some years back and his arrest, etc.
So cool.
So these are all things that it may not surprise any of you out there to hear. I know nothing about. I am.
And you started out skeptical in this interview.
I did
so
start
I just
out
want...
skeptical. And I mean, I am, you know, I'm protective of living, breathing artists. I'm always scared that work will disappear even more. But in fact, I think what Michael's talking about and what we discuss and the world that he is imagining and questioning and looking into is a world in which the actor, whatever, the artist, the musician, has a much more direct relationship with the possibilities that technology provides us to reach different kinds of audiences, to make our work accessible to people who it is not accessible to right now, and to kind of augment the experience of living, breathing souls in the room with a pretty much limitless palette of digital imagination. So it's fascinating conversation. I'm really glad I had it. I love doing this podcast because I learn things, and that's nice. And Michael's just like a super lucid talker, and he's this may sound like you're sitting there going like, what the fuck are they talking about? But believe me, when Michael breaks it down for you and talks about it, you'll understand a lot more about what he's investigating and why he's interested in the intersection between the digital and the actual realm in art. So that's coming up, Michael Wheeler, in a little bit. But first, Ali, we have a number of things to
discuss.
Oh, baby,
it's been a while.
The world is waiting with bated breath to hear our opinion on Taylor Swift
and
Ticketmaster.
Taylor Swift. Let's start there.
Let's start there, because I'm trying to sell tickets to my shows coming up in 10 days. Please get your tickets at urstars.com. Go check it out. I'm even better in person. I mean, obviously, there's the drawback of seeing me, but you can just close your eyes and imagine that I'm doing a podcast.
Day in the metaverse, I could completely change who you are and just have the sound.
Oh, God, wouldn't that be wonderful? Give me hair. It'd be amazing. But Ticketmaster / Live Nation, a monopoly which should not exist, which never have been allowed to exist, this week is taking a whole bunch of flack and heat most of all from Taylor Swift fans, because her new Eras Tour was put on sale, exclusive through Ticketmaster, of course, because they own everything. Yep. And what happened was millions of Taylor Swift fans were left very unhappy, without recourse, without any sense of how to get a ticket. The company basically had to shut their website down, saying that the extraordinarily high demands on ticketing systems and insufficient remaining ticket inventory means that we cannot meet this demand.
They had two pre-sales, and today, Friday, which we're recording, was supposed to be when they opened up for the general public, but it turns out that there's literally no tickets to actually give, which is just
so anyone who's ever said anything even mildly derogatory about Taylor Swift will know that you do not mess with Taylor. Her fans are vociferously passionate and will come for you.
Let's get them on climate change. And come on.
And now they are coming.
Income inequality, come on.
Yeah, now they're coming for Ticketmaster because 3.5 million of them had registered for this verified fan program designed to weed out bots and scalpers. And about 1.5 million of them were given a special code. And the other 2 million people were put on some queue. They just sat there all day. And you could see all day long on Twitter people being like, hey, I just missed heart surgery because I'm still in the queue for Taylor Swift tickets. So let me just first say this. I don't know if people are aware of this or not. There are other shows that you could go see. I'm just saying, you could also see a different show. There are other musicians making music. Now, you wouldn't know
that by
looking.
In fact, Ticketmaster should have a suggestion. Yeah. Why doesn't Ticketmaster do that?
Do you like Taylor Swift?
It's sold out. You're like, hey,
maybe you'd like to go
see
Stars.
You might also like Stars.
Yeah, exactly. We're not actually that far apart, musically speaking.
No, actually not.
No,
especially
we're not.
Yeah, actually not.
And it is just
who's that producer? That Jack Antonoff.
You know Taylor Swift.
You know
what?
He's just biting stars, man. He's a star.
He
biter.
Is indeed.
I like
Taylor. I think he'd admit that if you got him drunk. Taylor Swift had every song in the top 10 on Billboard last week.
Yes.
Guys,
yes.
This is not a sign of how huge Taylor Swift is. Okay, Taylor Swift is huge. What this is a sign of is the absolute collapse of the musical economy. That Spotify algorithms, playlists, the homogenization of every single cultural sort of platform we have into one huge lump of fuck has created a situation where 3.5 million people, I honestly believe a good portion of them, wouldn't consider going to another show this year. Wouldn't even dream of it.
Sure.
That's not a sign of health. It's a sign of health for Taylor Swift, but it's like saying if every restaurant in the world was a McDonald's and you know, you go around saying, "Oh my God, McDonald's is doing so great." No, the global food chain's breaking down. So,
you know, to be honest, Dork, I disagree because I actually view it that, you know, so many people had there's like a singular thing. There was a time where every Thursday night 40 million people in America
watched
not
Bill
counting
Cosby.
Canada would watch Friends.
Or Friends, yes.
No.
Well,
no,
Bill Cosby too. Hey, yeah, Bill Cosby too, is the biggest sitcom
there,
of all
there
time.
There were these, like, you know, we speak about all the time, like, why didn't we have a singular moment in which everyone was celebrating vaccines? Like, why don't we have these moments? And I'm really glad. It's just, for me, what the shit show of Ticketmaster, and I just want people to understand something here. Just in terms of numbers, right? So I think like 4 million people got access, 2.4 million tickets got sold. But here's the rub, folks. The system got overrun because 3.5 billion requests for tickets were made. Now, there's how many people in the world?
8 billion.
7 billion people? 8 billion people.
So fully half the people in the world wanted to go see Taylor Swift.
No. Basically, 3.4 billion robots got into the system.
Right.
And on a bunch of tech podcasts and a bunch of tech websites, people were like looking at like what's called the JSON of the thing. JSON is like a database and it tells you everything that's happening inside the website. And it turns out that, like, you know, it would say there's 2,000 people ahead of you. No, there was like 200,000 people ahead of you. And there weren't human beings that are buying these tickets.
Yeah.
And these robots, what they're doing is they're pushing the algorithmic pricing to a point that is insane.
Yeah.
So it is absolutely broken.
Yeah.
And there has to be a way that we create some system in which it's like, I get it, you know, Taylor, there's a finite amount of seats here. I understand that supply and demand is a real thing in economics. We cannot, you know, fight for that. But there has to be some equitable way in which these tickets are dispersed, number one. And number two, and this is a question for you, Torque. Imagine if you were in Taylor Swift's position, would you impose a financial ceiling to how much money you can make?
The answer to that question is yes, I would.
And how do you determine that? And
well,
and
you
why?
Just do you just you you know you you're smaller than you could be. There's plenty of artists who do that.
Do you cap ticket prices?
Yes, you absolutely cap ticket prices. Of course you do.
Is that something that should be done by government, or is that something that should be done altruistically by the artist?
It should be done.
Because I'm trying to figure out the alternative to Ticketmaster, right?
It should be done by government. It should not, because the artist ultimately has nothing to do with dynamic pricing. That is what Ticketmaster has set up. And I'm not even going to use that ridiculous phrase, dynamic pricing.
Yeah, it's like a death tax.
Come on. It's just usury. It's just straight up fraud is what it is. You know, it's like it's artificial inflation of the value of something. And
that's
if you do
my
it on
point.
The stock
it's
market,
artificial because there's
if you do
robots.
It on the stock
there's
market,
robots.
You get arrested, right? If
no, you do it happens all the time in the stock market. Algorithmic trading is happening all the time in the stock market where stocks
but you
move
should
up
get
and down,
arrested.
Purchases are made. Yes, yes.
You
yes.
should
so
get
this
arrested.
Is what I'm
because
saying.
It's like, effectively a form of insider trading, right? It's like saying, we're going to buy up all these tickets with bots and then we're going to say, ooh, look how popular Taylor Swift is. Sorry, now they're $5,000 a ticket. But this happens.
$11,000 a ticket.
Just give me a break. This happens when monopolies happen in businesses, right? The reason it is more expensive to fly from Montreal to Halifax than it is to fly from Montreal to London is because Air Canada is a monopoly in those airports. You cannot fly from Montreal to Halifax if you don't fly on Air Canada, so you don't have a choice and Air Canada gets to name the price. And this is why competition in the marketplace is important. And when you don't have any competition and you have monopolies or megalopolies, which is essentially what Ticketmaster and Live Nation is, because they're not just controlling the back end, i.e. the ticket sales, they're controlling the front end, i.e. who gets booked. Yeah. And they own the venues. They are taking, and by the way, they take 30% of my merchandise every night when I play Live Nation venues. So they
we should
are
explain
on
to people,
every... Yeah.
We should explain to people why competition would matter. Here's what I mean. If the tickets for Taylor Swift's show were sold by let Ticketmaster exist, but let there be also a competing service. But that competing service says, you know what? Come to me, the cap $500 or the cap $1,000. We will have dynamic pricing, but our cap is $1,000. All of a sudden, Ticketmaster is like, oh, fuck.
Oh, fuck. Now our tickets are $800.
People, yes.
It
so
drives
in one respect,
the ticket
what they're
price
doing,
down.
they're using quote unquote market capitalism terms like supply and demand to be like, this is the way it goes. Of course, tickets are $11,000. But what we're saying is no. Competition.
And it's also such bullshit to say that because ultimately, like, they are also doing massive damage. You know, Live Nation owns about 80% of the clubs in America now. From 400 seaters to 20,000 seaters, Live Nation owns pretty much everything. You have got to go out of your way now to not play a Live Nation venue when you go on tour. And when you buy a ticket for a Stars show from Ticketmaster, the amount of money that we're charging is almost doubled by fees from Ticketmaster. So people go and they try and buy tickets for shows and they say, holy shit, this is extortionate. I can't believe these bands are taking this much money for me to go see some shitty indie band like Stars. We're not even remotely seeing any of that money. So they are discouraging people from buying tickets to smaller events because the price of the fees is so exorbitant and so ridiculous, people can't afford to. So they are... To me, what's crazy about what Ticketmaster and Live Nation is doing is in the short term, and we get into it a little bit with Michael about this, the corporation is a psychopath. When you go public, when you go public, you are beholden to your shareholders. And the shareholders have no personhood. They have one thing in mind, which is getting profit off the money they spent. So Ticketmaster is actually creating an environment where they themselves will fall victim to their own success. Because if they keep doing this, there will come a time they will hit that ceiling. And this Taylor Swift event might be part of that. where they realize, A, we don't have the technological capabilities to deal with all the tickets we're trying to sell. B, people have actually stopped buying tickets even to our biggest shows because they can't afford it anymore. And C, the venues that we bought in order to control the marketplace, the Danforth Music Halls, the wherever, those places can't book bands anymore because we have made the economy such that nobody buys tickets for them. So I don't understand their long-term goals here. That's what puzzles me about the situation.
About that.
It's short-term gain for long-term pain, it seems to me.
But Torque, the disparity of income is so high that there are all Taylor Swift needs to do is to find 2.5 million people who are looking for status.
Yeah,
even
but
if they don't like it.
What I'm saying is that if those people spend $11,000 on Taylor Swift, they're not going to spend $45,000-$50,000 on stars.
But Ticketmaster doesn't give a shit about stars. It doesn't care about the smaller clubs. So for
but
them,
they
it's,
should
it, it works
because
out.
Because they own those clubs. And because I still make, and lots of people still make them money, right? Like, it's just Taylor Swift. It's
not nominal,
it's
basically,
Phoenix,
is what you're saying.
It's Haim. It's bands that sell 10,000, 20,000 tickets a night. It's nothing to shrug at.
Haim is going to be, you know, with her.
Haim's
going to
be on tour
shows.
With her. But do you know what I'm saying?
I need to ask you a question.
They're cutting out the middle of their business in order to support the top end of it in the same way that Spotify is doing. Everything is geared towards this top-heavy model of like, let's prop up two or three massive artists, let's make massive profit off of them, and everyone else is kind of on their own.
And fuck everyone else.
And I just don't think that's a long-term plan.
So where's Taylor Swift's responsibility here? Because Taylor Swift, let's not forget, like when she wants to stand up for something, she stands up for something.
She sure
does. For the longest time,
respect to Taylor Swift.
Her music was not in Spotify.
She's done a lot for other artists.
Yeah.
I want people to understand that. Taylor Swift does use her power pretty bloody well, actually, and often advocates for things that benefit her, but also benefit other people. So, you know, I think she's an extremely clever woman. And, you know, she released a press release today, clearly pissed at Ticketmaster, saying that they had been assured.
Really? I don't buy it.
Well, you know, listen, man.
I don't buy it.
Taylor
because,
Swift
you know,
is
she,
not just Taylor
she
Swift.
She has the power
she's
to change the industry,
she's a machine.
Though.
There's lots
but
of people
she
involved.
She has the power. If anybody wanted to be like, you know what? I'm not stupid. I know what's going to happen. It's been 4 years. She was supposed to be on a tour before. There's like 4 years of pent up demand for me. And I've only gotten bigger. Right? I don't understand that, like, because this actually goes
well, you know,
to the other
Pearl
thing.
Pearl Jam tried to do this 20 years ago. They tried to fuck up, like, they tried to leave Ticketmaster, and people laughed at them, derided them, made fun of them, you know.
But I think if anyone could have done it, it's her. But you're saying they also own the venue, so they own the entire stack. So if you're not going to work
with
Ticketmaster on purchasing.
Ticketmaster and Live Nation are bigger than Taylor Swift. It's hard to believe, but they are.
Damn.
So it's like, and Taylor Swift is not just Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift has management teams, lawyers. Yeah. There are other people making decisions along the way. She's not capable of just sitting there like the Wizard of Oz and making good decisions all day as an individual. So, you know,
I guess, Torque, the question I ask is, you know, because, you know, the whole FTX scandal, FTX was a market for crypto, and then that basically lost all their money. And guys, just to tell you something about crypto, it's very simple. If withdrawals and deposits are not insured, that's why crypto's stupid.
Buy a baseball card.
Because
if you want to do something, buy a baseball card.
There's a reason why there's the FDIC. There's a reason why there's a Bank of Canada. Like, there's a reason. They're not perfect, but sometimes you need human controlling the machine. Anyways, let's put that aside.
Yeah.
But the issue is that Larry David got paid millions of dollars to be in a Super Bowl commercial. Tom Brady.
Not
Giselle.
Good.
Not good.
Not good.
Now,
where is
the response? Pretty bad. Now, they're being sued in a class action lawsuit.
Good.
And I ask this to be like, does Taylor Swift have a responsibility here? I feel like she's just being like, well, they promised me that it would be whatever. It's like, come on, girl, you knew what was going
on. Nobody wants to accept liability for a fuck up. And Taylor Swift has a whole ton invested in her fans, obviously, as all musicians do.
But, the Swifties, baby.
But maybe even more, you know, because she does ask a lot. She released a deluxe version of the album she'd released a week before, a week after.
Yeah.
You know, she has done things that no one else in the music industry has done, at least in decades. So there's no question that Taylor Swift is hell-bent on being the biggest musical artist of all time, and she looks like she's going to make it. So I can't speak to her motivations. All I can say is that I do think that my sense of her and my sense of looking at what she's done over the past 5 years with her career is that when she feels the opportunity is right, she does step up and tries to do the right thing in as much as you can if you're the biggest artist in the world. So for me, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted the other day that that this monopoly should never have been granted, that Live Nation should never have been able to buy Ticketmaster, and that they need to be broken up. And then Elizabeth Warren also talked about it. Suddenly all the Amy Klobuchar started tweeting about it. As soon as the senator's kids couldn't get tickets to Taylor Swift, they were like, wait a minute, what's going on here? We should break this monopoly up.
Wait till Live Nation drops an envelope in every one of their homes.
I do think that they're now going to face some pressure and that questions are going to be asked about whether or not this is doable. And honestly, like, this is the crazy thing about capitalism to me is, like, why is endless growth the goal? Why is there this insistence? And the answer is because if you go public and people are shareholders, they want dividends every year, baby. They're not content to just have it sit there. So, you know, we have to ask ourselves whether these kind of organizations should actually be allowed to be publicly owned. I think that is a question that needs to be asked.
I don't know about that. The thing is, I am not against maximums. I'm for maximum gaps. And I think that's the issue, that it's the gap between, and this is not just in respect to the Taylor Swift concert, but it's funny that it shows itself, because if you don't have access, unless you're really freaking lucky, if you don't have access to $11,000 a ticket, it's that is inherently wrong.
Soft Revolution is brought to you by Effin Birds. In my continuing efforts to do a different accent from the British Isles every week, I've had to step outside the actual Isles and go more into the Commonwealth. This week I'm presenting this ad to you in a kind of like slightly bored Melbourne accent, which is different than a really aggressive, like chippy, upbeat Sydney accent. I'll do that next week. This accent comes from a kind of place of like, yeah, I spent a couple of years in New York, but I got bored there. It was awfully cold. So I moved back and now I'm running a skateboard shop with my mates and it's absolutely fantastic. Effin Birds is a great daily comic strip and it kind of just takes like birds, like really cool birds, you know, pictures of birds that this guy Aaron Reynolds draws because he's amazing at drawing. And then underneath them, they put sort of profane musings about just how fucked up things are, you know, which is a strange combination. Like, why are swearing birds so compelling? But apparently they are because Aaron, like, rules the internet. So anyway, every week, my friend Ali Moman holds up a card for me and I read it. And this time it's in full brilliant Technicolor. It's a bird sitting on what appears to be a kind of holly bush, so it's got a slight Christmas theme, and he looks like a wee finch or something. He's got nice decorations around his eyes, and this finch, who could not look more innocent and, you know, unassuming, is actually thinking in his bird head, this, is it bring a dumb out? This bird's thinking this. Is it bring a dumbass motherfucker to work day? Excuse me, bird? Are you talking to me? Your friend from Melbourne? Is that's not that cool, mate. Like, chill out, you know? I'm just a guy doing an ad. There's no need to be so mean about it. Anyway, listen, check out Effin Birds. It's incredible. He does T-shirts, he does mugs, he does all kinds of things. And he also sells the comic strips at, like, local bookstores, online, and he also presents every day the comic strip at your local satanic social media website. So Effin Birds and Aaron Reynolds have been just super kind to us, like super groovy and super cool, and we love him. So support him the way he's supported us. Go to effinbirds.com. That's EFFINBIRDS.com. Effinbirds.com. Or just check it out online, and I'll see you at the beach. Tra-la! Well, speaking of maximum gaps, let's go on to talk about the maximum gap between how we all imagined the midterms would go and how they actually went. I'm going to do a little mea culpa here because I was terrified.
Yeah, me too.
I was terrified that our focus on identity politics would kill us in the midterms. I mean, but instead, what happened was the worst outcome for the opposition party at a midterm election in decades. The Republicans barely got Congress. They did not get the Senate. And
they might have even like ended up there, if the, with the runoff with Warnock, it might get to the point where they've lost seats
in the Senate. Yeah. Thank you, Jesus. Hooray, hooray, that these lunatics are not going to be able to run the asylum. I do think Joe Biden's in for a tough 2 years because all they're going to do is investigate him. But here's my take on what happened. I think what happened is that over the summer, the Biden administration did a pretty fucking amazing job of refocusing people on the economy, of refocusing their message on working class economic values. And I think that the Democratic Party should take this as a sign that when you talk about the economy and you talk about work and you talk about affordability and you talk about things that affect people's daily lives, they really, really respond. The other thing I think that's extremely exciting is that Gen Z voted in enormous numbers. They are now the largest voting bloc. And although they tend to be obsessed with identity politics, they are committed to saving the earth and would like a future.
Right.
And there's no way in hell.
Wait, just to clarify, Gen Z wasn't the most, didn't make up the majority of the votes.
No, but they are the largest voter
bloc.
They are the largest potential voter bloc.
And
they
used
did
to be,
turn
yeah,
out
yeah, yeah.
in spades.
They turned out very
they
well.
They turned out big time. And they got us over the hump in a lot of places where we might have lost to Republican challengers. So thank God for the young people. But also, I think that should come as a really dangerous, like the Republican Party should know that their days are numbered, that the people under 30, they don't.
I'll tell you why
you know,
I disagree,
they,
but go on.
They're looking at this and saying, like, unless we do something, we're not going to have a future. So to me, climate change, the economy, jobs, income inequality, housing, keep hammering it. Keep talking about it and stop talking about bullshit, culture war nonsense, because everyone's over it. And thankfully, I think Joe Biden and the people around him saw that coming and made a hard pivot and fought hard. And thank God they came up with a good result. Tell me why I'm wrong, please.
I love it when you tell me why I'm wrong. I kind of took a different kind of view on this because there's two states that if you look at, those are the two states that the Democrats have to be like, uh-oh, in an alternative reality, we would have got decimated. That's New York and Florida. The Democrats in New York, blue New York, did not perform well. They lost seats in blue counties. They lost seats in ways that you would not expect.
And that really was about wokeness, right? Like that was the,
no. Yes. No, 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 no.
You don't
it's
think
because
so? The crime,
no, no, no.
the focus it's, on crime, no. all that stuff, you don't think?
It's because in New York, what wasn't on the ballot? Abortion wasn't on the ballot. Democracy wasn't on the ballot.
Interesting.
You weren't galvanized.
Yeah.
But the states in which abortion, and even Florida with Mr. likely maybe next president of the United States, Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis never acquiesced to Trump's election lie. He didn't have to because Trump won Florida. So he was very lucky in that respect.
Yeah.
Also, Ron DeSantis was not an abortion absolutist.
Right.
He is a 15-week
guy.
Now, 15 weeks, we might not like that. Me, I have my personal views on abortion. I'm not going to go into the details, but I'll tell you, let it be after 15 weeks. I'll be fine with it. That's not my place. It's not my place.
Yeah, it's not my body, so
but
I don't have a fucking opinion that matters on it.
Exactly. Not my opinion. But 15 weeks is actually a lot more in line with the majority of Americans and actually great portions of democratic Europe.
Yep. I mean, it's not,
so,
yeah, people have
and the
wide
other example,
variety
yeah,
of views on abortion.
Yeah, wide variety, yeah. Whatever. And the other one is Brian Kemp. Brian Kemp, governor of Georgia, defeated Stacey Abrams decisively. He got close to 55% of the vote, right? Brian Kemp, also, what did Brian Kemp not do in Georgia, the place where Trump was like, just go find me 11,000 votes? He didn't acquiesce. He didn't give Trump. So
great,
again,
great point. So let's touch on this a little bit, because one thing that seems to have happened, Donald, I mean, it's amazing, right? That we have not even, we're now almost half an hour into this podcast, and we haven't mentioned the fact that Donald Trump announced he's running for president, because it was such a damp squib. It was such a non-event. The New York Post's headline was Florida man announces candidacy, see page 27. So he has lost. He has lost Fox News. He has lost the New York Post. He's lost Rupert Murdoch. It looks like Rupert Murdoch is going to go full bore behind Ron DeSantis. And he's yesterday's man, is he not? I mean, I really feel like despite his cult-like ability to get millions of people to come and cheer for him, those people aren't serious politically. And I don't think he has the Republican Party anymore. I think this is one loss too many. Do you not?
Yes, I think it's now, I'll tell you how he can win the nomination. He can win the nomination how he won it in 2015. He needs as many people as possible running. Uh-huh. The reason being is, as long as he has 25, 30% of support, he will win.
Right.
Because everyone else, this is what happened. Everyone else stayed. Donald Trump slid in with 20, 25% of the vote. Other people got 5. Rubio got 4. This person got 6. Whatever. These are winner-take-all primaries.
Mm-hmm.
So Donald Trump kept on racking the delegates. So he wants people, either he wants it to be, let people think that he's weak so that more people come in.
Mm-hmm.
Or the worst thing for him is a showdown between him and DeSantis. If it's between two people, Trump is a goner. If it's between 6 Republicans, Trump is a winner. And his big hope, I think, is that nobody else shows up and he has enough sycophants that he becomes the de facto nominee. But I think after the midterms, there's a confidence now to say, this is not our guy, this is not our path, and we need to exercise it from within. And I will say this, I know DeSantis sucks, but if you want my opinion, the best thing that can happen is Ron DeSantis runs and he wins. And Ron DeSantis kills Trumpism. Trumpism can only be killed from within. An Obama-like person can't save us. An AOC can't save us. A Buttigieg can't save us. It literally, Darth Vader has
to
kill the
Emperor
Palpatine.
Yeah,
okay,
they have to eat themselves. They do.
Yes.
Speaking of eating themselves, Elon Musk has had quite a week. I'd like to personally thank him with no irony whatsoever for destroying a website that I have been addicted to for some years and truly despise, despite the fact that it's the way I've earned my living this year. One tweet earned me my living this year. But it is such a shitty website that I still don't care, that I'm still happy that Elon Musk in 40 days has Liz Truss himself into being the most incompetent tech CEO in the history of tech.
Oh, I can't wait to tell you why I think you might be wrong.
Well,
but go on.
Again, I love it when you tell me I'm wrong.
I love it.
I don't have much to say about this beyond this. This is going to be good for all of us people. If Twitter shuts down, it may feel like you're missing out on that platform that you sold your work on. God knows I will. But in the long run, those thousands of hours of wasted attention, those thousands of hours of wasted thought will come back to people, and you will be able to communicate with them differently through a different platform. The attention deficit will go way down in our economy, and suddenly there will be a vast amount of attention for sale. You know, I heard Bo Burnham talking about this, the terrific comedian, talking about this the other day, that, you know, first they colonized land, then they colonized our bodies, they sold us deodorant and perfume and clothes. Now they're colonizing our time. They're colonizing our attention. And this is a decolonizing of our attention.
It's being taken from us.
So the more these things fold, the better, even though the disruption and the pain might be short term. I really believe that for all artists, for all people who are selling their stuff on Twitter right now, and that includes me, we are actually in for a long term gain, because we will have won people's space and time and ability to interact with our work more back. And that is a good thing on balance. Now tell me why I'm wrong about Elon Musk, who, let's face it, the guy's a moron. So you built a rocket. Hasn't somebody else built a rocket? Like, didn't he just Google how to build a rocket? What's so special about this idiot? I don't understand.
I think Well, you know, we can't knock Elon's ability to galvanize groups of people towards exceptional products that are singular. And that's just a given. You can't knock SpaceX. You can't knock Telestat. You can't knock Tesla. You just can't. But here's the thing. The difference with the social media thing is that it's not about building a product, a great product. I mean, it is, but it's comprised of like 300 million people. And I think what we're learning is that Elon Musk is terrible with people. He has terrible social skills. I'm not going to go in there and diagnose him, but I bet you there's a list of things
that
we could say that he might have.
Social media was developed by three guys with the worst social skills I've ever seen in my life. Like, it's ironic.
Sure. Somebody well, called Alanis Morissette. Get women, so they created, they created some way to get women. But here's what I actually think is going on. First of all, the amount of people, I know this is like an Elon tweet, but the amount of people complaining on Twitter about Twitter on Twitter, and the amount of people announcing they're leaving.
Yes.
It's just the increased usage of Twitter. I'm like, guys, do you understand what's happening here? And then also I will say this, there was a report that came out and this is going to go a little techie. So I'll just explain it to you. But when you code something, when there's a team, if team of people coding, you do what are called commits. And commits to a project get recorded, and it tells you how many lines of code Torque has committed, how many lines of code I have committed. And one of the things that Elon Musk saw was that in Twitter, they had 7,500 employees or something, but only 10% of the employees were committing 90% of the code.
Interesting.
So you basically had a culture of slackers, which is fine. I'm all here for it. So I think, because I want everyone to make a lot of money and not do anything. That's my dream. That's
me
my dream.
Too.
But I know, right? I know. But I think what is actually going on is that Elon is trying to destroy Twitter on purpose so that he can rebuild Twitter in his image. He cannot take this version of Twitter with he's fundamentally trying to break. Yes, he's breaking the culture and he's doing it on purpose. He understands that the only way for me to make this into a product or a service that I could then sell for at least $44 billion, which is 3 to 4x what it's worth.
Right.
He's got to break it.
You don't think this
is
just guy with a Twitter addiction and no friends?
No.
I mean, don't you think those two things are true?
No. No. I think he's I don't think the Twitter that he wants to create is a Twitter that I agree with. He sent that email to everyone and said, if you don't want to work 10-hour days, if you don't want to do this, get out.
Well, they all quit. 75% of this workforce quit, apparently.
Exactly. Yeah. Good. That's what he wants.
Right. That's what he wants.
He wants to cull. He wants to find out who are the 15% who are insane. And those 15%, I'm going to make you God. And I know you might think this is insane, but when you ever read the stories of Steve Jobs and the Macintosh in 1984, that also was Steve Jobs making sure that he had a group of people that would work 20-hour days. He would tell them, you're not going to see your family while we make this product. Now, I do not equate Elon Musk with Steve Jobs, and the difference being that Steve Jobs was actually an artist. And for him, he's far more creative. And I think there's a beautiful thing that Steve Jobs made and constantly. But I think this is all on purpose. This is all by design. He is doing everything meticulously and he wants this. He wants it to break.
Interesting.
So that he
can
build it
again. Interesting perspective. You'll only hear it here on Soft Revolution from former Apple genius, Ali Mohman.
It makes sense though, right?
Yeah, it does. And it brings to mind a question, which is if tech's going to be the future, and it has such a personal influence on people's lives in a way that other major forces, oil and gas or hydroelectricity or food supply, tech has this way of reaching into our minds, into our souls, into our personal habits, and that's where they're colonizing our time. Is there not going to be a very big problem if Silicon Valley does not start to include the notion of ethics in what they do? And this is maybe a good segue into our conversation with Michael Wheeler about how tech might play a role in performance moving forward. Because as long as we have the Mark Zuckerbergs, the Elon Musks, who, let's face it, they're just not good people. They're not good. They don't have good values. They weren't well raised. They're not kind. They're not imaginative. They're not thoughtful. They're not empathetic. They're shitheads. And that can't be allowed. I mean, surely we have got to create some sort of legislation or system of checks and balances where one person's dysfunction cannot have a fundamental effect on the way we live our lives. No?
There's an organization that I encourage everyone to just be a part of, and you could be in any, there's a huge kind of like range of how big your involvement can be. It could be just like receiving emails from them weekly, being able to like check out, you know, free conferences and stuff that they have. And it's called Humane Tech, and it's a consortium and a group of people who think about this a lot. And it's by the guy who used to be a Facebook engineer, but he did the Social Dilemma. He's the main guy in Social Dilemma, and it's him. And he was on 60 Minutes with Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan Haidt, who did famous for writing that article in The Atlantic, The Coddling of the American Mind, and then also most recently that article that was very famous on The Atlantic that we spoke about, just about how like the past 8 years have been stupid, has been the stupefying time, and it chronicles what happened in 2012, the algorithmic change and all that stuff. So I definitely would encourage people to go there. They're speaking about the policies we've spoken about a little bit. Like right now, for instance, again, I'm going to mention the notion of local data portability. Everyone's talking about going to Mastodon right now. No one's going to Mastodon. Why? Because you can't take all your data with you, all your data that should belong to you. You have to start anew and start fresh. The only way that we are going to be able to create competition is if we create a system in which you can take your photos, your tweets, your images, your videos, and your friend list onto another social media platform. It's actually not a difficult thing. You can open source all these aspects because every social media platform is ultimately the same. It's a network of friends. It is a set of data that you put out and a set of data in which you've interacted with. You've liked it, you've retweeted it, you've whatever. That's it. That information should be yours and it should be able to be taken everywhere. That's what needs to happen. On the other end is this. I want Elon to create a product that is worthy of $8 a month. I want him to.
Yeah.
Because the business model, we talk about this with Michael, is the problem.
Right.
And the business model of like engagement, which means enrangement, in order to get advertising, in order to get you hooked, that's the problem. Yeah. And if we can make it so that the company is making money anyways,
you don't have to be hooked.
You don't have to be.
Right.
They're going to make you hooked. They want you hooked, but they're not incentivized to make you a terrible, destructive, worst version of yourself.
I mean, I have a Netflix account, but I don't watch Netflix 12 hours a day, right?
Exactly.
So it's
exactly because they're making revenue.
Right.
But now that Netflix is moving to an ad model, what's that going to look like? What are the products that they're going to make?
Big questions.
What is that going to be about?
Big questions. And one of the biggest for the people who listen to this podcast is how will tech influence our little world of turning the lights down and trying to sell people a ticket to a story that we're telling them.
Yeah.
And Michael Wheeler has some really fascinating and exciting ideas about what that might look like right here on The Soft Revolution.
Michael Wheeler on The Soft Revolution. Michael, you are the co-artistic director of The Spiderweb Show, correct?
No, not true anymore. I was artistic director.
Okay.
Now I am director of artistic research. And Adrian Wong is the artistic director of the company.
Oh, gorgeous. Okay, so explain to us what Spiderweb Show is to the people listening.
Yeah, so Spiderweb Show started about 10 years ago, actually, as a commission by the National Arts Center, kind of through their commissions series when Jill Kiley and Sarah Stanley had just taken over there. And so Sarah actually was the original artistic director of the organization. And we built it up, and Adrian Wong joined us in that first year. And then eventually I became artistic director, and I was artistic director for a while as we moved the operations here to Kingston, where I'm talking to you from. And then as I became a full professor here at Queen's, we transitioned to Adrian Wong becoming the artistic director. So we've been around for 10 years. One of the three of us has been artistic director over that time. And, you know, what is Spiderweb Show? Spiderweb Show is an organization that's trying to figure out what's going on with all this digital stuff and live performance. So, you know, when we started out as a commission of the National Arts Center, it was like, we were, you know, a blog that was kind of having these questions with artists from across Canada. But I have to give credit to Sarah that she always understood that, like, the more interesting question wasn't like, could we have a cool blog, but like, could we operationalize the internet to do theater with? And so that's kind of been our journey from a blog to like actually a, like a company that produces and presents this kind of work.
Amazing. So what's great about this is I was just saying before we started rolling is that I'm a huge believer in the integration and digitalizing theater. I think it's going to be, particularly in respect to virtual reality, mixed reality, augmented reality, I think there's a huge opportunity here. But we have somebody in the middle, and his name is Torkel Campbell, and he is a disbeliever.
Well,
he hates it.
Let me say this.
And so
I
our
think
job,
primarily, yeah, above all, I'm an ignoramus. So it's easy to be a disbeliever when you're an ignoramus because you know, and God knows being an ignoramus now is almost a qualification for having an opinion. So I'm not a disbeliever. I think that's a misnomer. And I am walking into this conversation very much, very, very, very unable to discuss the realities of the tech behind what you two are espousing and what you believe in. So I'm going to start from sort of the ground of it, for which for me is, what is theater, right? Like what constitutes a piece of theater? And what is the difference between theater and, say, film or television or performance art or any number of other things? And I guess for me, the answer to that, and Michael, I'd love to know your answer to that, because I think that's where the conversation can actually get really great. For me, theater is still, as much as I want it to be other things, it still feels like theater only happens when I'm in a room with a group of people. I can feel the resonance of their voice hitting me. I can smell the lady's perfume in front of me. I can hear the creaking and the coughing and whatever is going on in the room. And we fight that fight together, audience and actors. And at the end, if it's successful, we kind of forgot that we were not living this together. But it's that physicality, it's that actual smell, touch, taste thing that for me constitutes the difference between theater and something else. Why is that not true for you? What is it about what you're doing that you hope to expand that definition for me?
Yeah, you know, I come from actually like a really traditional theater background. So
as you know, I do too, which is, you know, that's part of my problem, I'm sure, you know.
You know, I trained it mostly with like Russian directors and at the Moscow Art Theater and like with through Stanislavski technique. So,
wow.
You know, these kind of core things are... I get what we're talking about here. But I guess I would say that, you know, I think Stanislavski would say that the meaning of theater is to reflect the reality of the human experience back to the audience. And the reality of the human experience in 2022 is a hybrid one. We live our lives and with our families and our friends and our jobs and physical reality. But we now also have like, we're connected to the hive mind. How many times are we checking in on Twitter and like how much are we getting information from Facebook and all of these different digital things? And so the human experience is now a partially digital experience. And so that's how I kind of connect it to my understanding of like what the role of the medium is.
And does that mean for you that you're able to be at home and click on something and tune into a show digitally? And it's satisfying for you? Because I think one of the things that, of course, we all tried to, that horrible word, pivot to during COVID was, you know, we all tried to do shows online. Everybody was doing various things. Some were successful, some were very much not successful. How did you feel about that period of art? And how does it, like, what did I not see that you feel VR, virtual reality, could bring to that?
Well, I wouldn't just say VR, because, you know, Spiderweb Show and our festival Fold, we curate works that use lots of different digital technologies.
Right.
But I feel like that's a different question than the original one you asked, Torque, which is, you know, what's my response to the work that got made in the pandemic when we all pivoted?
Yeah.
And my honest response to that is, like, you know, I've been doing this work since like 2008. So like about 12 years, like trying to figure out how to do it. And watching everybody try to do it for the first time, seeing the results, it was pretty tough.
Yeah.
Like, you know, an analogy might be like watching everybody like pick up the oboe for the first time,
right.
Declare that a professional presentation,
right.
Got bad feedback, now oboes
right.
suck.
Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
True.
Yeah. So,
you know,
go ahead. Sorry.
People have to be good at it. It's just like the rest of art. Like, it's a craft that
yeah.
people build up like expertise mm-hmm. at over time. And, you know, I can think of a lot of incredible works like this. We can get into it. But you know, I didn't see a lot of excellence in people who built up their craft at one very specific thing mm-hmm. and were then trying to just overnight mobilize it into being a different thing.
What's the money factor here? Because when you guys talk about this, and it sounds thrilling, I mean, I would love to bring aspects of this into my live show and music as well. You know, like, I think it's not just plays that could be changed fundamentally by it. It's live music. It's anything live. But it's expensive, right? And as you say, it requires expertise. It requires that there be someone, a part of the artistic process, who really understands computing, who really understands coding, programming. And not just that, but as an understanding and a relationship with how to take that technology into a live space and make something work every night. Can you talk a bit about how fast that's improving? Whether you think in the long term or the short term, there's going to be the equivalent of, say, GarageBand, you know, for this kind of tech? In other words, something that you could learn in an hour or two and that actors could actually not show how bad they are at relatively easily.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're onto something there. Like, you know, within the film world, I think people are really talking about the revolution that will happen in the next 10 years, because like stuff that only Hollywood studios could do, that like a lot of people are going to be able to do on their laptop now, and like how that's going to flatten that industry out. And I think we can draw some parallels into like digitally engaged live performance, where some of that stuff that just seemed really expensive and hard will be simple, kind of like, you know, how Canva like has made graphic design like a different type of thing. But there also is like a fundamental kind of question about the hard costs of specialized labor, especially coding. Like, almost everything in VR is happening mostly in Unity, although there is another code that people use. But, you know, someone who's good at coding in Unity that also has an artistic temperament and can have an artistic conversation, like, that's really specialized labor that's not, that you know, you have to pay for. You know, I guess the best solutions that I've heard from this right now is there's kind of like a sector-wide study being done through the National Ballet and the Canadian Opera Company, and they're looking into the possibility of like, how could the industry, specifically in Toronto, kind of share resources around this, whether it's staff or whether it's hardware and software, because it's just not going to be feasible for arts organizations to each have their own inventory of these people and equipments, and the equipment's changing all the time. And so I do think, if a bunch of organizations in a like close geographic area are all in on doing some of this work, they would benefit from sharing resources that way.
I want to talk about, like, just because I know there's a lot of people who probably are not fully aware of what the possibilities are and what these terms are that we're going to be speaking about. I just want to break down, if you could break down for us, the difference between augmented reality, virtual reality, mixed reality, and why you think that could touch the art while you are even seeing it live, and how it can shape the art while you are at your house.
Okay, great. Very good questions. Thank you. So, you know, no, it's true. Like, what are these things? So, like, VR stands for virtual reality. So that's like when you put a big headset and like you erase your reality that's around you and you then live in a virtual reality. AR stands for augmented reality. So you still stay living in your reality, but it is augmented in some way. And like the simplest way for people to understand that is if they did Pokemon Go 5 years ago, that's like probably the most successful example of AR. And I'm actually a bit confused why there's been nothing like that since that, since it was so popular.
I know,
popular.
It's crazy, yeah.
I don't know if you remember, but like they had like a really rare Pokemon at the ferry docks in Toronto, and like it started making like people couldn't get off the ferry anymore. And like, yeah. I don't know, it was very popular, and then nobody ever did anything like that again. And then mixed reality, I guess, is moving in between the two, and the two are related. So Oculus has essentially released, or Meta, or whatever you want to call it, Facebook, one of, you know, this entity that works off of data and is now moving into hardware. They released three headsets. So there's the Quest 1, which is like the first one that everybody could use that you could get in the market. And there's the Quest 2, which is much better. And those are both VR headsets. You put them on, you can't see anything else. But actually their third one, the Quest Pro, you can see, like, you can see down and you can see out the side. And there's a new mode in it called pass-through, where you essentially have cameras that show you what's in front of you in color. So is you feel like you're seeing the room around you when you use some of the applications. So it seems to me that the commercial hardware that like you and I could go to Future Shop and pick up is going to be a mixed reality thing where like, oh, I want full VR and I wear my headset that way, or I want it to do AR for me and I do that with the same piece of hardware.
And the potential of this, particularly the Quest Pro, from what I've been reading and what I've been seeing, is that people are watching movies through these headsets, and they are watching it in a way as if it is set up that they're sitting in a theater, that there are applications that do it. Now, they might not do it well, but yeah, I'm always about like, where are we going in 10 years? So if they could do it in a rudimentary form, I go, okay, keep the ball going. In 10 years, I imagine myself being able, the three of us, hey, let's watch a show. And everyone is, you're in Kingston, you're in Vancouver, I'm right now in Madison, Wisconsin. We all go and we see a show together, and as if you're sitting beside me. I don't think people realize that, Torque, that's where we're headed. So you talk about this notion of, you know, Taylor Swift has a finite amount of tickets to sell, regardless of, you know, Ticketmaster and bots and whatever. At the end of the day, it's an issue of supply and demand. But what happens when you have a situation that there's actually an infinite amount of tickets that can be sold and that experience can be shared and viewed? It might not be exactly the same as seeing her live, but sometimes close enough.
Well, this is the thing, is like, and I guess that's why my original question was like, what is theater, you know, because maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe these definitions are kind of old hat, and maybe I am protective of an art form that I feel depends on people, living, breathing people, when in fact what we're talking about is like theater, but it's also a bunch of other experiences, and that the word theater maybe doesn't actually speak to what the experience ultimately that you're speaking about is or will be for the viewer. I mean, I'm just thinking now that there's been a lot of work over the last 10 years or so, you know, with very complicated amplification systems in theaters, right? So extremely, I can't remember what the name of that one-man show was, but there was a show where people wore headphones and there was sound coming in from all directions, and they were using sound in this incredibly nuanced, subtle, complex way, required a lot of tech, to give you an auditory experience. Now, you were live in the theater, but you weren't hearing the resonance of the actor. You were actually listening to the actor through the headphones. So when I think about what you're speaking about, Michael, in terms of mixed reality or augmented reality, I guess what we're in the future we're looking ahead to is, say, Mervish will do a big musical show, and when you go into that musical show, you'll be given a pair of glasses, say, that will, you'll be able to see the stage, you'll be able to see the actors on that stage, but then suddenly magical things will appear, or we'll be able to affect the set, or is that what I'm you're saying?
Or even at the base level, imagine if, you know, we have ASL shows, assisted sign language, yeah. and we do two or three of those in a run.
Uh-huh.
If you have glasses and these glasses have a microphone that are doing instantaneous dictation, it's over. You no longer need sign language.
Right. So I love all this. I guess the question is...
So I'm saying lean in.
Yeah. No, I think that all sounds exciting, actually, to me.
Michael's going to be a billionaire, and we're going to be like, he's leaned in early.
Well, this is why we're having him on the show now, so that we can suck up.
This is like the first time anyone's ever like postulated that I might become a billionaire. So I'm going to enjoy it.
He's an undying optimist, Ali Momin. That's one of the things I like about him. But it does come back, I guess, to, do you consider your job with your company to be explaining this a lot to people? Like what kind of attitude are you finding when you talk to traditional theater institutions or cultural granting organizations? Are you finding that there's a big gap between people's understanding of what the potential of these things is and what people imagine them to be?
Well, I would say that, you know, there's kind of a couple of different stages. There was like the pre-pandemic stage where like I was like this niche experimental artist who like had this thing and this festival that was looking in this thing that seemed to be emerging, but like was one of many things. And then there was this 2-year period where that like niche interest became the only way that any of my friends could make art. And so,
hey, Michael, how do I plug this camera in? I bet you got that call a lot.
every imaginable kind of call for a couple of years there. Right. But also, those years are over now. So this is an interesting time, right? Like people can do their thing again. They don't need me to do their thing. And so like what is the value of that work on the other side of this is like a pretty interesting question to me. I should note that the only time Spiderweb Show ever went into consulting was during the pandemic, kind of to answer these questions on a kind of macro scale. And we were hired by a consortium that basically called themselves like, I don't know, most of the theaters, Soulpepper, CanStage, Native Earth, many others. They hired us to kind of write a report on like digital, what should Toronto theater do? And we came to two conclusions. Like one was that post-pandemic, there's going to be a more hybrid form of theater, that though shows will start to move to like having one performance live streamed, or like, you know, having those glasses that Ali's talking about, that all these kind of, like, let's call them digital augmentations, I guess, companies will be more into. And those are like more straightforward and obvious in many ways. The other thing that we tried to emphasize in this report was that in terms of accessibility imperatives, you can't really argue against this. Like most companies aren't making their AODA like responsibilities already. There's a way for us to get caught up and be more inclusive.
Sorry, what does AODA stand for? Just so I
oh gosh, Act for Ontario Disabilities.
Okay, so the Disabilities Act, right? Gotcha.
Essentially, if you get money from the Ontario government, which is like every Ontario non-profit,
you got to meet certain standards.
We should all
standards.
Be doing things. We're just not doing them right now. So it's a way to get caught up that way, and. And also, you know, we understand what these things are from the pandemic and having lived through them, and they don't really challenge our questions of what theater is, like what we started talking about at the beginning of this podcast. But the other thing we tried to point out in the report is that that kind of evolution, I'll call it, is different than the other evolution, which is like this new form of theater where there is no physical form. And like, we're all using the internet to come together in digital form and co-occupy digital space with one another. And it feels real. Like, you know, when you're in VR and your friend is talking to you from your right, you only hear like through your right ear, like their voice, and like you turn towards them and then you hear them fully. Like, so there's like an occupying of space that happens, but it's with your digital form, not your physical form. And I think it's an open question. It's the question you asked to start, is like, is that still theater?
Yeah, I guess the other thing for me is...
Or a bigger question is that fun? I think the most important thing is, I think, regardless of what you think about theater, is that hopefully you love it and it's fun and it brings about joy. And the question that I have is, I'm a huge proponent of like mixed reality. I think some VR is good, but I wonder if that complete and utter digital occupancy of humans, where it's all digital, and if that's going to be fun. And I think Zuckerberg is making a bet that that is the way it's going to be. I mean, I know Apple is coming out with some glasses. I mean, that's what the rumors are all saying. They have a more kind of like, no, it has to have a human element to it in every respect. So I think that's going to be
interesting. What are your thoughts on that? Do you see the day when Meta, like in the metaverse, you could go and watch an amazing play?
I just closed the play last night that I directed that's entirely in the metaverse. So.
So then the answer, of course, is yes. It's already possible.
Okay, so talk to us about the process of making it, but also talk about the feedback that you got from people, because that's really interesting. That I think for us is important to hear, because I always tell a lot of like younger theater makers are like, what should I do? I'm like, I think you should learn how to code. I think you should learn how to use these technologies. I think this is the future. So.
Well, I'll just, you know, before I get in, I'll just say that, you know, our stage manager, Justine Katarenchuk, she graduated theater school 2 years ago, and like, you have to book her like a year ahead now, because she's the only like experienced VR stage manager. Right. So there's definitely like a niche world there mm-hmm. for people who are just are looking to be employed. Mm-hmm. So what we did actually is we took a piece of theater that we made 10 years ago called You Should Have Stayed Home, which was a big hit at the SummerWorks, like 2011, I think. One man show about Tommy Taylor's experience being arrested and detained at the G20 protests. And so that was like kind of a monologue-y show. And so then we worked with a team to turn it into kind of a tour of Tommy's day, basically, in VR. And so it's like essentially you show up and there's room for 10 people at a time. And there's a sound design. And there's a lighting design and there's a set design, but it's kind of an ambulatory show where you go through, like, you go to St. James Park where he started, and you go to Queens Park, and then you're where the people got pepper sprayed, and you get arrested at the Novotel, and then we take you to the film studios where everybody was jailed, right. And you get to see what it was like there. And that the way you attend that show is that you buy a ticket, and then you put on your headset at the right time, and you open up VR chat, and send a friend request to the person we tell you at the right time. And then you do that experience virtually with 10 other people from around the world who just have headsets.
Fascinating. And how did it go? Were you pleased with what, like, did it happen in the way you imagined it in your head? Were there things that you were surprised by in terms of how it worked and or didn't work?
I guess, you know, I should, in full disclosure, we also presented it at Fulda in June. So this presentation at the PXR conference was our second crack at the can. Mm-hmm. And so that always goes better because you've already had like a run with an audience and kind of figured things out. You know, the thing is, like, you can't have enough people to help with onboarding in the beginning. Like, even with kind of these experienced VR users that have their own headset and like know how to navigate to the specific app at the specific time, the settings of all these things are always a bit different. And so we always kind of like, you have to have like, we have like a virtual stage manager and a virtual board operator, but we also try to schedule at least two people that are just in world.
Right.
So when people show up, we can be like, hi, you're at the right place. And like, you need to do these
ushers,
things.
Digital ushers in a sense.
Yeah. Wow. Basically. Yeah, it's really important. If not, it just becomes like a big cluster, you know, at the beginning of the whole thing.
So let's talk money, because to me, I mean, we are, you know, the arts are chronically underfunded, yada, yada, yada. We all know that, especially in this country. And it feels like, you know, I think even people who are into tech will agree that tech has made it harder in many ways for live art to exist, in the sense that money is just harder to come by, audiences are harder to come by. But is there a time in the near future when you feel like Soul Pepper or, you know, Native Earth or any of these theater companies could present to a director as an option working within the digital realm on their design, whether it's through design, whether they want to do it fully in the metaverse like you just did? Like, how much money is this going to take to become a part of the not-for-profit cultural fabric, I guess?
I don't, you know, I've been working in theater for a while. I've seen enough budgets. I don't think You Should Have Stayed Home in VR cost any maybe like a 20% more than like your average indie like theater budget that's using like equity actors. Right. I mean, I got away with that a little bit by doing a one-man show, so I didn't have to hire seven actors and had a little bit more to spend on development.
Yeah.
That's the big cost in the specific kind of VR, AR framework of works.
Is people?
Is that...
It's still people?
It's what you call developers, like people who know how to...
You can't pay those people $700 bucks a week, right? Like they...
You can't. Yeah, you can't.
They're not actors. They won't just do it for anything you throw at them.
I mean, I think context is that if they were salaried, they'd be six figures.
Right.
So you know, you got to think about that. And then... You know, the thing people are, I do get the question on like, now that you've made a show, like, what's your big advice to people? And like, I feel like we got so lucky that our developers were also artists at heart. Like, and so that's another layer. Yes. Like, not only do you know Unity, but like, can you have an artistic conversation about what you're making is really key.
And that's
key.
A whole sort of, to me, it seems would be at least a generation before we get a significant number of people who are like record producers in the sense that, you know, like people I work with on records, they are musicians, then they learn the tech and they bring that bring that artistry to the tech, and that's why we call them the producer, because they can take my idea and interpret it technically through the mixing board and make it happen. But that takes a while, right? I mean, that is not something that is quick.
Yeah, no, it's not. Syed Talabesi, who was the core, like the lead developer in our show. We got lucky because actually he's not from theater, but his dad is a theater director in Iran. And so he just kind of grew up at the table with that kind of sensibility. Right. And then he has dual degrees in animation and architecture.
So
he can bring that to the table. And so, but yeah, that's kind of, I don't know what they call it, the stopgap. That's where you need someone like that.
Are you as a university professor?
You know, the word they use all the time, the intersection.
Are you, university professor, interested in the notion of there being programs around this? I mean, should we be, as Ali said,
or should it be at least in theater school? Should it be in theater school a little bit?
To be teaching kids code if they're going to National Theater School, or at least teaching them how to use VR and AR in some primary way, in the same way we teach them to use their voice or any other thing we teach.
I think maybe Andrea Lundy should think about her production students learning code, because I see a lot of designers needing to know it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to know how to code, and I'm going to continue to do this work.
Interesting.
And I'm not sure that the performers need to know it either. They need to kind of understand the way that the work is created so that they can make their process fit into the production timelines, I think.
But I think it's probably important to, you know, just at least show what is possible and to show just even the rudiments of this. Because it really is. And also now we have a generation of like kids who all they want to do is like be TikTok stars, Instagram stars, digital stars. That's what they want to do. They want to thrive digitally beyond, you know, for them getting a million likes is equivalent to having 10,000 people in a stage. In an auditorium. I don't know.
There's still technology kids who, my daughter is still at musical theater school every day, you know, hoofing it. Mm-hmm. You know, I do think that's, you're right, Ali.
It has to be both. It has to be both. And I just find in theater school a lot of the times, I mean, most theater schools still don't even have a proper film and TV program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Most theater schools still don't do commercial. They don't teach them how to do commercial. They don't teach them how to do voiceover. So basically, you know, they are so stuck in just, let's just do, you know, straight, proper, just theater, but not actually... equip the students for all this technology that is in front of them when they come out.
I mean, I do have to shout out my employer at this point, because I do teach in this program we have at Queen's called Media and Production Performance. Mm-hmm. And so that's a medial between the theater department and the media department.
Interesting.
That's amazing.
So you get a bit of both.
And is that one
way.
Of a kind, and, Michael, or is that something that's happening in other schools?
I, Probably my boss wants me to say yes, but I haven't researched it well enough to be.
We don't research anything, so just say yes. Just you go.
I think it's a good program, and certainly, you know, we have definitely moved our resources into this kind of metaverse question.
Uh-huh.
Of like how to make sure that our graduates are have some exposure to these questions.
You've been incredibly generous, but I did want to focus on one last thing that I guess hangs me up, which is like everything else that we do with tech now. You know, the internet started as this beautiful place where everything was free and nobody owned it. And very quickly it was subsumed and controlled by a very small number of people, huge tech companies. You had to work with Meta to do this. No, you didn't have to work with Meta, or you did.
Well, I had to buy
their equipment. Yeah, so in order to tell this.
And I felt conflicted about it, just to say that was like a problem.
Right.
And I worked really hard to find alternatives and there
was just isn't. So yeah, I guess my last question is like, what's your hope? What's your, in 10 years, where do you want to see VR, AR, tech, these things? What part do you want them to be playing in the work that you care about, just as Michael, an artist, a theater artist?
I'm so happy you asked me this question. I swear to God, yesterday I was thinking about part of what you asked me. I was thinking about how like Google used to have like do no evil in their motto, and like the Arab Spring, people were naming their kids like Facebook and Twitter, and like it was like so utopian.
I met a dog named hashtag. I met a dog named hashtag at that time. It was sad,
and you know, and now here we are. Like those three names are just dirt, right? Mm. And I think something happens when companies go public where like once they're serving the shareholder, it doesn't really matter how good the people are that are working there anymore.
The corporation
like,
is a psychopath,
revenue.
Right?
And so I think that's a warning that whatever the new solution is, like we got to keep it like not-for-profit or open source or like, or just privately owned by people who aren't psychos. But like if whatever the new thing is, the real danger will be if they just try to turn it into something and go public, because that seems to kind of pervert these platforms.
Yeah.
My only hope though here, Michael, is that, you know, I don't think Meta is going to be successful in this endeavor. I think Apple's going to eat their lunch. Mm-hmm. That's just my opinion. Mm-hmm. But I think Facebook moving away from the business model of for us to make money, we need to sell actual things as opposed to just getting you addicted to a product that we can serve you ads. Mm-hmm. I think my hope is that that pushes them actually to be far more humanistic and to be far less driven by making us destroy each other. Because that's what Apple does is although they are moving into advertisements in respect to their app store, but their MO is to get you to buy as many physical products. That is still how they make their money. And that business model is something that is really, really important. So I'm hopeful.
But to get back to the hope part for you, Michael, I mean, that's because I would like to announce that I've gone from skeptic to intrigued and somewhat excited.
He's getting a Quest Pro.
I'm getting Tor a little bit a excited Pro. Here because I'm starting to realize, especially around the disability question and the question of people you know, I often get emails, letters from people saying, hey, man, you're playing a show where I can't get my wheelchair up the fucking stairs. What's up? You know, and it's just hard for me to believe that venues still don't have a way for someone in a wheelchair to come see my show. It just blows my mind. So what is the hope for you in 10 years? You know, Spiderweb, where do you want that to be and what do you want to be doing with it?
Oh, well, you know, Spiderweb Show, if I'm going to talk to my hopes for that company, I would say, you know, we have this festival, FOLDA, Festival of Live Digital Art. And it really just came out of like, we were like, there's not one place to just check in annually on like what's going on with this evolution.
Mm.
And so let's start it here. And like, we've really kind of staked our reputation and our budget and our activities on this festival growing and becoming bigger each year. And so my hopes for the company are really connected to, you know, that festival becoming like a major international festival, just to put it on the table. And we grow a bit each year and the Times has written us up now. And like, it seems plausible to me anyhow.
It sounds like you're well on the way for sure. Yeah.
And then, you know, the other thing, the big transition that we've made is, so the leadership team is now Adrian Wong, Marcel Stewart, and myself. And we run on a consensus-based leadership model that we call the Triangle. And so, you know, we're trying to be a creation company too. So that show I talked about, You Should Have Stayed Home, that's my creation with the company. But Adrian and Marcel also have works that are in the pipeline right now. And so, you know, that as artists that we use this company to kind of provide new, weird, and wacky ways into this type of work as well.
Well, I think it actually sounds kind of thrilling, Michael. And like, we never answered the question of what is theater, but I kind of feel like it doesn't really matter what the answer to that question is. And that, you so know, true. Art, like, as long as we're still making art, which means, as you say, like, speaking stories, telling people stories, making connections between one person's story and another, that's all we need is those three letters in a way. So exciting. Thank you for enlightening the ignoramus about what you're doing. And and thanks so much for being generous with your time. It's really awesome to talk about this.
Oh, I'm so happy to be invited. Thank you for having me.
Michael Wheeler on the Soft Revolution podcast. Thank you so much, Michael, for enlightening me on all that stuff and on opening the doors to a much bigger conversation. I would love to have Michael back along with some people who maybe participated in that metaverse show. Would love to talk to the actor who was involved in that. Love to hear about the creative process and how it was different from doing it in the room. But like, for me, the takeaway on that one, Ali, is the notion of accessibility, you know? And that thrills me and excites me. And it's something that we've just tried to ignore, I think, in the live performance space because we got enough problems already and like we don't.
Yeah, it's a real equalizer.
But man, it's very important. And I think, you know, if you're not disabled in some way, then you're not aware it's a problem. This is one of the big issues around disability law is that there's not a ton of people who are disabled in our society, but there's lots, there's loads of them, and they have as much right to go out and enjoy a night out as the rest of us do, and there's very little done to make that possible for them. So whether it's ordering a taxi, whether it's ordering an Uber, you know, there's a small number of Ubers that can accommodate people who have mobility issues. Like, it just goes on and on and on, and we don't think about it, we don't talk about it, and we should. And I think tech has a big role to play in maybe opening that conversation up. So it was great to talk to Michael. Thank you. Make sure you check out his work. The name of his company is The Spider Web Show. And go online and check out what they've done. And go check out Michael's show, You Shouldn't Have Left the House. You shouldn't have, that's right, what it's called, right? You shouldn't have left the house. Sounds cool. Okay, that's it. What's your art pick, Ali?
Mine is kind of a life pick, you know, because I have the past couple cities I've gone to, one has been Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yeah.
Right now I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. Next week I'm going to Des Moines, Iowa. And I got to tell you, these cities are the sleeper hits. Incredible culture, great architecture, great food, art scene thriving.
Yep.
And these are cities that like you would never opt to go to if you were doing some kind of vacation. You would choose the big ones. You'd go, let's go to New York. Let's go to, you know, Miami or whatever. But, you know, what I encourage you to do is to go to these, I don't know, I wouldn't call them like medium cities. I don't know what the term
second
is.
Second cities, maybe?
Second city.
Second
city. Yeah, which is interesting. I wonder if that's what second city came from.
Yes,
Chicago.
Yes, for sure. Chicago was called the second city.
That's why
city.
They call it.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. Because not only are they beautiful and, but let's say in Toronto, there's like 50 kind of places that you got to go to. That's really cool. Man, in these cities, there's probably like 6-7 like cool, amazing restaurants.
Which is all you can go you to anyway.
Done. You get them done. So your experiences are not, it's not hectic, right? And everything really feels local and there's a real sense of community. And you being there, not amongst all tourists, there's something really lovely about that.
Yeah,
it's
Madison's
when I like to travel
great,
to Paris.
Town.
Madison's great, but I remember when I traveled to Paris, I've been there a couple of times. I had the most enjoyment when, not when I did the whole like, let's get a hotel, buy the Champs-Élysées and just go around. For me, it was like, oh, I'm going to be there. Let me get an apartment in Montmartre. Let me just be there for 2 weeks and let me just know what it's like to live like a part of them. And that's what you get in these cities.
Yeah,
so.
No, it's
really it's good to be
true.
Surprised.
Pick your vacations carefully. It's sometimes you really miss out when you don't go, as Ali says, to those smaller places. You kind of, it's like, you know, in Holland, for example, Utrecht is an incredible city. Nobody goes to it. No tourists go to it.
Never heard of it.
It's just as beautiful as Amsterdam. You know what I mean? It's just as cool, yeah. But nobody goes. So a lot of people now are starting to say, hey, Utrecht, you know, maybe I should go to Utrecht instead. And of course, it will then become overrun with tourists. But I do think that there is a lot to be said for what you're saying. And I find when I'm on tour that many of my favorite places to go are those smaller places where, as you say, I don't have to pick through 700 great restaurants. There's 4 great restaurants and I go to one of them. And they're awesome, you know?
Yeah, I know, amazing.
My art pick this week is, I don't know, maybe it's my single of the year. It just came out recently. It's by a guy named Chris Cummings. And Chris Cummings' musical project, he goes under the name Marker Starling. I knew Chris Cummings when I was in high school because my sister went to high school with him at the city school, and she was really close friends with Chris. Chris would come over to our house all the time, and even then, Chris seemed like a man ahead of his time and out of his time. He was like a 16-year-old boy, but he always wore blazers, and he was very kind and quiet and sort of sardonic and had this very dry sense of humor and was just a super cool, interesting dude long before the rest of us were. And he has continued to be that and has had this beautiful career as Marker Starling, making this beautiful, mellow, groovy, classic kind of soul slash pop music. And he has a new single out this week featuring one of Toronto's best young musicians, Dorothea Pass. If you have not heard Dorothea's work, P-A-A-S, Dorothea Pass, go check out her music as well, because it's incredible. And she's guesting on this track. And the track is called Yet You Go On. And I am telling you, you need to hear this song. If you're listening to this podcast, the first lines are, your talent might come to nothing. And you might, basically what the song is about is like, you may feel like no one's paying attention. Like there's only a few people who pay attention. Like you can't earn a living. Yet you go on. You go on for the fun of it. That's the chorus. Yet you go on for the fun of it. And you know, that's enough. And you should draw enormous comfort and a sense of pride in yourself for continuing, for going on, even when no one's paying attention. Because that is where the most beautiful artistic instinct lives. That is where we are most beautiful. Is in that room with no one around us doing this thing because it speaks to our soul and makes us feel better about living the day. And I just don't think I've heard a better song that encapsulates the artistic struggle and gives you just a little bit of a push, a little bit of a pep talk. It's been really important, this song, to me over the last few weeks. It's provided me with enormous comfort. And when you find a 3-minute pop song that can give you that sense of comfort, that's a miraculous thing. So my pick this week is Marker Starling featuring Dorothea Pass with Yet You Go On. We're going to play that as we go out for you. Thank you, as always, to Crow's Theater. Thank you to the incredible Aaron Reynolds and the incredible effin' fucking birds who have been our season sponsor all year long on Soft Revolution. We love you, Aaron. Thank you for your support. And, you know, go check us out. Go give us a 5-star review on Apple Music. Go write us an email. Go prove me wrong again.
Don't write us an email unless you really have something to say. Like, you know.
I actually don't have the password to our Gmail account, so I'm speaking for Allie.
Yeah, they're all coming to me, and it's all about Torque, you know, and I'm just like, okay, well, I think Torque actually, what he actually meant was.
Yet I go on. And we hope you do too. We'll see you next time on The Soft Revolution. We love you.
See you next time. Love you.
Nothing.